Our next guest is Sean Quinn, Sustainable Design Leader for the West Coast Office of HOK, a global design, architecture, engineering, and planning firm. He's here today to talk about biophilic design, which incorporates natural elements such as living plants, water features, natural light, organic materials, and views of nature into modern office environments and the benefits of this type of design. Sean, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
Can you introduce yourself and provide a little background?
Sure. My name is Sean Quinn. I'm the Sustainable Design Leader for HOK's West Coast offices. I'm based here in San Francisco, but work across our practice in Seattle and Los Angeles, and then across the firm as well.
What is biophilic design, and where did it originate?
So biophilic design is sort of the is design that incorporates natural materials, light, vegetation views to nature, and other experiences of the natural environment into the built one. It's sort of a concept that was initially termed as biophilia by a German social psychologist, Erich Fromm, around 1964. It really wasn't actually until the 1980s where a little bit more research was being done into sort of the innate need for human connection to nature by E.O. Wilson that the sort of biophilia hypothesis came to be. That's really the essence that we evolved in nature, and that as a result, we're drawn to natural settings that we as individuals either identify with and love.
Who are some of the other pioneers of biophilic design?
So beyond E.O. Wilson, around the same time, Roger Ehrlich was doing research in the 80s that sort of demonstrated enhanced recovery rates for patients in hospital rooms that had views to nature versus patients with views of other neighboring buildings or interior courtyards. Essentially, what was the aspect of how much quicker and better would someone actually recover from a major surgery if they're looking out towards lovely aspects of trees and nature versus sort of a harsh built environment? Some of those thinkings were really captured by then Stephen Keller, sort of around the late 90s and early 2000s, who really sort of championed the sort of principles of biophilia and incorporated it into that sort of that practice of biophilic design, and really did so by identifying six major elements across 70 mechanisms to create biophilic experiences through building design. More recently, Judith Heerwagen, who's a co-editor of biophilic design and has been with the U.S. General Services Administration for decades, has long sort of championed that sort of concept of bio-inspired design and sort of not only a sort of, you know, a natural connection, but what are the sort of modes of design and social interaction that are founded in natural principles.
Did you say there were six elements?
Well, depending on how you look at it, people have defined in different ways. Stephen Keller had identified six major facets.
What are they?
So some of them are essentially incorporation of environmental features, natural shapes and forms, natural patterns and processes, light and space, place-based relationships.
How did you become interested in biophilic design?
I'm not really sure when I wasn't. Essentially, I think my inspiration as a designer has always been in a holistic response to environmental factors, sun, wind, light, natural views, and water. So essentially, I think we've been doing biophilic design for a long time. Those aren't new concepts. I think it's more the formalization of it and sort of a more direct intent of it that's become more current. Even as early on as my thesis work was the design of a net zero energy, water, and waste and food independent campus in rural Rwanda. So I think there are a lot of designers out there that have sort of intrinsically focused on sort of the integration of art, science, nature, and culture in design. In the past decade, however, we've sort of seen this get a bit more formalized. As recent, I guess, as 2010, I became more formally introduced to the concept and its execution while at HOK, designing a healthcare project for the U.S. military, of all people, in Kaiserslautern, Germany. And so this is a hospital that is meant to treat wounded warriors when in battle. If their wounds are beyond what can be treated in the field or at a base, they're airlifted to Kaiserslautern, Germany, in sort of this lovely forested area in northern Germany. And the essence with that entire project, which is under construction right now, is ensuring that there are both respite spaces, sort of places of real, embedded nature and nurture, as well as for every single bed unit, they all have access to views to the forest around it. Nothing is inwardly looking.
Did you say that's not open yet?
No, that's currently under construction.
Is it the first of its kind?
Kaiserslautern Medical Center will be a first-of-its-kind building. It is a joint effort between the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as well as German municipalities. So really, it's a combined effort that sort of addresses modernizing healthcare codes and very different approaches to recovery within healthcare centers. More completed recently, or even going out a couple of years ago, our NOAA Center for Climate and Weather Prediction is in Maryland is sort of a three-tiered formed building. Each sort of program of the building sort of splays off of the other one, like wings of a hurricane. To be honest, is the inspiration. And it sort of lays in this lovely sort of prairie field right adjacent to a neighboring forest. And that sort of, curvature of the buildings creates a small inner center courtyard. And so essentially what we've done is to try and create a space and environment where all of the scientists that are actually predicting all of the major storm events that are coming up the East Coast can actually be surrounded by a slight microcosm of what's happening in the environment. And so as rain falls onto the green roofs of that building, it cascades down to a central rain chain, which funnels into a sort of a central bioswale, essentially like almost a natural wetland. There's a Ned Kahn sculpture, which are those little sort of tiles you can see flowing in the breeze. And so essentially as those people are working, they're being constantly reminded both through the natural cues of what's happening in the environment, but also through some direct physical cues of the building that tell them what nature is doing right now.
What are some of the biggest benefits of biophilic design?
I think that the biggest benefit of biophilic design, the real focus of it, is trying to really incorporate some of an enhanced benefit of health and overall well-being. That, in a sort of more modern, universal designed spaces, they can sometimes be a little bit sterile. We're trying to sort of enhance community connectiveness, enhance creativity, and increase productivity. And the integration of biophilic elements, whether they're some of those environmental features, shapes and forms, light and space, tend to just reduce stress and create a real calming force over a person.
What might people be surprised to learn about biophilic design?
I think that it's really actually fairly simple to integrate. I think it's hard to say biophilic design or biophilia without creating some either concerns of it being a disease or sort of conjuring images of complex vertical gardens and water features. And, those sort of, vertical gardens and water features are quite amazing. But at the core of biophilic design is really engendering that connection of personal references to nature. This can be as simple as visual connections to the outside. But increasingly, we're trying to then also look at some sort of, auditory, haptic through, touch, olfactory, smell, and even gustatory stimuli that might stimulate or enhance that connection that people have to previous experiences in nature.
Why are vertical gardens and plants important, and are there any plants that are better suited to biophilic design?
I think the incorporation of plants into a space can be really useful in terms of both, immediately creating a direct connection to nature. When we start looking at larger scale vertical systems or, a dense collection of plants, they can actually improve the air quality within a space. And so that can mean just essentially enhanced breathing, certain smells, all of which can create that sort of relaxing sort of essence. In terms of which plants, NASA has sort of, back in its research, sort of in, I think, the 1980s, had identified a series of plants that were essentially extraordinarily oxidizing. And essentially, it's sort of, following up on the Apollo 13 concept, how could you ensure that you could actually have enough plants that could sustain someone? So as the plants are breathing in our exhaled CO2, it breathes back back out oxygen. But there's essentially nine to 12 plants that are extraordinarily good at removing some of those toxins from the air.
Is room temperature a factor?
Yeah, so, you know, thermal and airflow variability can be a factor. And I think this goes back to the essence that sort of research kind of shows that people like moderate levels of sensory variability in the environment. We like to be surrounded by changes in light, that sort of essence of a cloud passing over the sky and reemerging. The sort of sound and temperature, when they're sort of environmentally devoid, can be a little bit sort of numbing. We like that sort of sensory stimulation variability, can sort of encourage sort of excitement and activity, while when it's more static, we have a tendency to become more bored or passive.
Can you describe HOK's offices in San Francisco?
Yeah, so as you can tell from the sounds, we are located right off of Market Street in downtown San Francisco, about two blocks from the Embarcadero Center. We're sort of on the low level of a 1960s office building that sort of comes at a few key intersections. And so actually from pretty much almost anywhere in the office, you have views to at least one of four neighboring plazas. So we both have aspects of views out towards trees, to a courtyard where people are playing giant-sized checkers, to one that has sort of a large water feature fountain, and then one to sort of a lovely mid-century modern pavilion. But there's essentially a real great variety of light and colors and patterns on the buildings around us that keep us pretty toned to it.
Are there any famous buildings or monuments that demonstrate a biophilic design?
Oh man, there are so many. I think you could go all the way back to the Pantheon in Rome, whose oculus sort of allows the sort of passage of sun throughout the day and totally transform the way you perceive that space and a little bit of drama of light and experience through it. More recently, since the sort of concept of biophilic design has been, we'll sort of say, formalized, you have the Thorn Crown Chapel by Faye Jones is one of the most common examples we see in biophilic design. This is a chapel in Fayetteville, Arkansas, that is, a non-enclosed structure. So a timber structure that is sort of oriented through trusses, but with no solid walls. So you're constantly surrounded by the forest around it, while being under partial coverage. You can go a lot more extreme than that sort of really like nature-based example to Park Royal on Pickering in Singapore by Woha Architects, which is a hotel project where every single balcony has essentially like a pretty lush tropical, not only garden, but almost like forest feature outside of it. So every single room, no matter what story you are in the building, from the first floor to the 20th floor, you're looking at, palm leaves, resonating out. And that's really meant to sort of evoke the sort of, the hospitality that you might be able to experience in places like Bali and Indonesia, but brought into the city. I think more recently for us here in California, we have a recently finished project at HOK called Central and Wolf that is a speculative office building for J. Paul Company, which is now being being occupied by a technology company here in the Bay Area. And with that project, we, at a very speculative rate, were able to sort of unite both the sort of coastal oak biome with the redwood forest biome that you find in the neighboring areas and create a series of courtyards around the office spaces. And so across your office floor plate, you have views into some inner courtyards that are shaped by patterns of the sun and the placement of plants. You have totally shaded views out to the outside through an undulating spectrum of shading fins. And then a central courtyard, which has relocated redwood trees that are growing out from it, while the outside edge of the parcel is essentially oakland. And so really meant to, reinvigorate, which was a very heavily oaked Silicon Valley several decades past. And so one part of it is sort of unearthing what was, hidden by parking lots for a long time. bringing in other parts of the neighboring environment into it, while then creating a office environment that really blends the boundary line between inside and outside. And with that, you're able to then go out into those inner courtyards. And for about, you know, half the year, it's pretty comfortable just to work outside. And under the shading canopy of a tree, you can do so without the glare even on a monitor screen.
Did you say that was in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, that's down in Sunnyvale, California.
Are there any examples in the greater Sacramento region?
I think one of the other projects that we had finished going back now probably about 8 or 9 years is the CalSTRS headquarter. So it lies, you know, directly adjacent to the Sacramento River. The whole project is oriented along the sort of river to take advantage of prevailing breezes, to optimize response to the movement of the sun over the day, so you get really good daylight without a lot of heat gain in the building. And then down at the base of the building, we have sort of a double height curtain wall lobby that's properly shaded, but it has views out both towards the river and the sort of tree-lined trail that runs along it, but also to a garden that the staff has built out there. And so essentially, as you come into and go out of this building, you're not only cued to some of the natural ecosystem outside, but also to some of the available nutrition that can be, you know, brought into the building or grown in the area.
What was the name of that building?
That's the CalSTRS headquarters. That's the California Teachers Retirement System.
Do you see any recent trends in biophilic design?
I think, you know, there's a really significant trend now to try and incorporate more living systems inside of our buildings. And so I think for the past 50 years, we've been trying to be totally isolated. And now there's a real essence to trying to figure out how we open our buildings back up. And that at one level is trying to incorporate better aspects of natural ventilation to a building. But then also, as we already mentioned, the aspect of bringing plants into a space. And I think that is really meant to sort of both improve air quality as well as imbue space with, the sort of natural colors that are sort of calming and linked with focus as well as concentration. And I think the next aspect, sort of a unique trend that's been going on for the past several years, has been a real focus on urban agriculture and in turn vertical farming. How can we actually bring in food production systems into either an office space, into your kitchen at a really micro scale level, or even into other factories and spaces?
Is it becoming more popular?
I think so. I think we see rooftop farms are becoming like a major social trend, where there are a lot of people that, you know, while, you know, they live in a very dense urban, you know, space, want to be able to get their fingers under, you know, dirt, and really begin to reconnect not only through, you know, visual and sort of, you know, sensory exposure, but real active life. Our Eskenazi Hospital in Indiana features a rooftop farm on it, which allows patients both to go out and sort of enjoy the sort of, you know, regenerative space, but also really get engaged with cultivation of the plants, which is both part of the healing process. We have aspects of a project next to the Atlanta Falcon Stadium, where we've and created some community gardens meant to help bring the neighboring community that sits next to a very large-scale stadium embedded within the process of that. And I think there's aspects of which you're then reinforcing values of, cultivation of the environment, but also increased education about nutrition, as well as a real community connectedness, while probably the very early inklings of beginning to sort of start addressing some of the issues we have with how long it takes for food to come into cities.
Are there any specific industries or geographic locations at the forefront of converting their existing spaces to biophilic spaces?
You know, I would sort of say I'd say Asia has probably for the longest time always been doing it. When you look at both contemporary as well as traditional architecture in Japan, throughout parts of China, in Southeast Asia, you'll see a lot of not only the sort of natural cues brought into buildings, but a lot of the cultural cues still maintained within construction. that you'll see a lot of wood joinery still being done in Japanese architecture, and even Singapore really investigating how landscaping relates to a building is something that's been going on for, you know, decades, if not centuries. Within America, I sort of see there's a little bit of a resurgence of how we can re-embed craft within our buildings. I definitely say that the West Coast, because there has been such a strong job of, you know, maintaining our natural park areas. There's a real connection with nature here, and I think, as well as a sort of a culture of health, and I think that aspect is being brought into it. I'd say on the East Coast, in cities like New York, is where you start actually seeing all these sort of rooftop farms popping up, where you're so embedded in an area that doesn't have direct access to some of those natural parks, people are trying to find artificial ways of building them into it. And then even I would sort of say across the Midwest, you begin starting to see continual ways of looking at rehabilitating old warehouse buildings, retrofitting existing structures that are then taking advantage of salvaged wood, horse fences, things that are embedded with some kind of culture and iconography of that space. And so I'd say every kind of region of the country is doing it in a little bit of a different way, and that's good. It means that it's sort of being rooted in the culture and social sort of views and values of that area.
What are easy ways to modify an existing space to create a biophilic design?
You know, I think one of the first things to do, you can sort of begin to sort of incorporate. We talked about, you know, the use of the plants. I think imagery of nature can be really important at the very, like, simple surface level, where if you're in a, you know, big, expansive office space, even putting up imageries that are representative of other, you know, natural areas can be a really nice, simple connection. I think for those who are doing designs of those sort of retrofits, actually looking at nature around it and sort of pulling from some of the patterns and colors and embedding that within the finishes can become that sort of, you know, next small piece as well as layer. And then finally, if you're doing a more sort of, you know, we'll sort of say deep embedded process, looking at how you can reincorporate natural light and pretty typically into like large footprint office buildings, whether or not ventilation can come into it, if there's any way to create water features or even sort of create some sound formations or sculptures that sort of cue people to what's going on in the environment around them.
Do you have any cost-cutting tips?
Cost-cutting tips. I would sort of say, you know, going with something that's sort of, you know, vintage or salvage doesn't necessarily create a lot of cost. And there's essentially a lot of things that we can find in, you know, salvaged yards that are being, that have a real story and richness to them. You know, I think when we're sort of looking at trying to like re-oak Silicon Valley, it's essentially trying to actually take some of the wood that has been, you know, cut down and reused for something else and bringing that back into the building and space. It both has the natural qualities that are sort of directly connected to that direct aspect of nature, but also has some of the indirect ones about social and cultural views that can be sort of imbued into a space.
How do you envision the future of architecture and biophilic design?
You know, I think, you know, offices, you know, over the course of the past, you know, 50 years, maybe up until recently, have kind of become the modern day factories, and they tend to be a little bit universal, and that allows for flexibility and adaptability and sort of has the intention of being, you know, increasing collaboration. But often in those sort of open environments, they can become noisy and distracting. I think the benefit that biophilic design brings into that is that I think that built environment sort of returns a little bit more to some vernacular roots. You bring in aspects of, you know, culture and context that people respond holistically to. I think there's a way that we can then sort of advance some of the means of construction to handle some of those aspects of acoustics, creating spaces that are more interactive rather than just being heads down that have those views to the outside, or maybe there are actually outside. So people can have that variation. And so I think there's a sort of a need for sort of a dual view, both of the past, or sort of our understanding of culture, context, and nature, that provides the foundations for some exceptional design. But that needs to be combined with some of the sort of innovative thinking that's going on in the building industry right now. How does technology, both through improved fabrication, finishes and materials that can abstract out some of those natural principles, and even things like 3D printing as well as automation that can enable more customized pieces that could take on natural forms.
What are some of your favorite things about biophilic design?
I think it's just really calming. I think that sort of aspect of it is extraordinarily important. I think as the country and really the world is continually urbanizing, it's extraordinarily important that we not only think about how to do something without consuming as much resources, but we also need to think just as much about how people interact with the buildings, how their relationship with the built environment can also influence their relationship with the natural environment. And so when we go about designing either someone's home, really thinking about how just a small, vertical planting wall in the kitchen can become a really nice calming essence as you, come down to the morning for breakfast or able to pick a few mint leaves that you mix in with your juice and that sort of essence of continual response with the natural world. In our office environments, we're certainly seeing some really cool aspects about sonification. How do you almost visualize what's going on in nature outside that you don't maybe have as much of a physical connection with through other auditory systems? And so recently, just learned from a couple different groups that are essentially converting the sounds of rain outside, measurements and light levels, and trying to convert them into sort of sound waves and how that might sort of enrich a lobby space. And all of that begins to try and take a little bit of the hustle and bustle that is just inherent in the urban world and really abstract it out to something that's very different that we haven't seen or experienced before.
What more would you like people to know about biophilic design?
I think that it's not all plants and water. I think we have a rich cultural and natural history in our cities. And there's a real sort of, essence of trying to, I think the biophilic movement is just about advancing how we, build in a way that's more humane, but also really trying to sort of reinvigorate how we bring and sort of relight some of the lost natural systems that we have, that we had in our cities. And through conventional means of construction, either, moved over or pushed to the outskirts of the city. And so I think biophilic design needs to be some of just as much as a building aspect, a real community aspect of how do we sort of reconnect ourselves with some of our social interactions with nature.
What more would you like people to know about HOK?
Really that HOK, we're a large global firm, but that, inherently we view ourselves as being responsive to the local conditions of everywhere we work, from culture to context to cost, and that we work at all scales, sizes, and typologies. Products as large as, the Atlanta Falcon Stadium that I mentioned, its roof is inspired by a flower and creates its operable oculus. And that creates this sort of, wonderful indoor-outdoor arena and stadium. But then, that aspect, same aspect, that outside we have those ripple effects, those small community gardens that invite the neighborhood in, are hopefully become part of the context and culture of, sport, nutrition, and ultimately community. And so regardless of what we're working on from, a small interiors office project, all the way up to major healthcare as well as stadium projects, we want to understand the communities and where we're working more, and that we understand and recognize that those projects have major ripple effects, and so dozens if not hundreds of smaller scale projects emanate from them, and we really see as the core of our mission to try and embed the urban environment as one that really cultivates the natural environment. While also really enriching, society and our connections with our communities.
Where can people learn more about biophilic design?
People can learn more about biophilic design. I'll pitch our website a little bit on HOK.com under thought leadership. We have more information about this. I'd say that the International Living Future Institute has done a phenomenal job at trying to create really accessible case studies and processes in which to look at integrating aspects of biophilic design. Their biophilic design initiative is continually looking at how do we connect people with nature on a daily basis. Terrapin Bright Green has done an excellent job of writing out some of the principles of biophilic design. So those are all great places to start.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
You know, really just I sort of say that, you know, again, sort of maybe reinforcing that last piece, that as we begin to look at how we continue to build in cities, whether it's Sacramento or San Francisco or far off reaches in Asia, that we always investigate the sort of natural ecosystems of place first, and that the real aspect and sort of methodology of building this out is to sort of, you know, consider where we've come from. And that can really allow us then to sort of identify the sort of ecosystem services that are available. How do we passively integrate those into a project? We can develop a material palette and sensory factors from that. And then we can really integrate all the other cultural habits that engage with the movement around a space, as well as how we even engage ourselves in the community. And I think ultimately that's what biophilic design is trying to do. It's not simply a reconnection with natural elements. It's a real, you know, movement to sort of reroute ourselves within nature and sort of, you know, a more, you know, calming factor in society.
That was Sean Quinn with HOK. For more information about biophilic design, visit HOK.com. That's HOK.com. If you have any questions regarding this program, please address your correspondence to Public Affairs in care of this station. Thanks for listening. I'm Sarah Quelland.